Hey everyone, this is James Wilson with MTB Strength Training Systems and BikeJames.com, and welcome to another Bike James podcast. In this podcast, I want to talk about why you don't want to use your ankles to absorb shock when you're riding your mountain bike. And this is a common piece of advice that's given to people, that you need to use your ankles to absorb shock. And this is one of the reasons that people are told that they want to be on the ball of their foot on their pedals. And being on the ball of the foot can mean a little bit different thing to different people. You could be cheated back a little bit towards the back of the ball of the foot as opposed to being directly under the center of the ball of the foot. But the point is that you want a single pressure point under the ball of the foot, because this is what's going to allow your ankle to move the most, and that's going to allow your ankles to act as shock absorbers. Now, this makes sense on the surface, but like a lot of things in mountain biking, when you start to scratch at the surface a little bit, you realize that it doesn't really hold up. It doesn't go very deep. And being on the ball of your foot to absorb shock is bad advice. It actually creates a bad situation for your foot, where you're going to increase your chance of overuse injuries and increase your chance of acute injuries and actually make it harder for you to absorb shock. And so this first came to my attention when I released the Catalyst pedal, which is the world's first midfoot optimized pedal. It is long enough to allow you to get support under the ball of the foot and the heel. So it stabilizes the pressure out over both ends of the pedal, as opposed to having a single pressure point under the ball of the foot. And I started to get some pushback from people in the skills training industry, particularly about this ball of the foot, you know, so you could use your ankle to absorb shock. And the example that was given time and again was a vertical jump, that if I jump straight up, when I land, I want to use my ankle to help me land. My foot, ball of my foot touches first, and my ankles are moving to help absorb shock. And if I jump and I land with a flat foot, then it's a much more jarring landing. And so this means that you need your ankles to absorb shock. And this is why we need to be on the balls of our feet to use our ankles on our mountain bike to absorb shock. Like this is the logic train that is usually trotted out there as far as like why we need to do this. But there's several holes in this argument. But like I said, unfortunately, a lot of skills coaches and skills coaches organizations have bought into this idea and made it really, really widespread. But like I said, it's bad advice for you. You want to not use your ankles to absorb shock. Your ankles are not shock absorbers. All right. So first off, I want to explain that you also have to look at the context, right, for how we're moving on our bike. And so being athletic in one context doesn't mean you're going to be athletic in another context. So being athletic in the NBA is different than being athletic in the Tour de France. You have to establish the context to understand how the best way to be athletic in that context is. And so when you look at our mountain bikes, when you look at us riding our mountain bike, our feet don't come off the pedals. All right, so this is a different context than if you're running or jumping or even doing Olympic weightlifting, right? Olympic weightlifters do jump off the ground. Their foot breaks contact with the ground for a split second. So all of these examples, and these are common examples given by people in the skills training industry for why you want to be on the ball of your foot for various reasons. But this is a different context than what we're experiencing on the bike. On the bike, our foot is not coming off the pedal. And so we have to look at situations and sports that have that same context to draw more direct lessons from. We're not going to be able to draw as many lessons from sports that have a different context than we do. But unfortunately, this is one of these things that just does not get understood in the mountain bike industry. We continue to talk about other sports and situations that don't have the same context as ours in order to try to justify some of these things. So, you know, that's the first thing. So you can already see like the vertical jump is a poor example of absorbing shock on your bike because you're not landing from a jump. So a better example would be like doing a kettlebell swing. Okay, your foot is staying in contact with the ground and you're having to absorb energy. You're creating energy as the swing is coming up, and then as the kettlebell is dropping and you catch it at the bottom, you're absorbing energy. And you're doing this with a balanced foot position with the both ends of the arch supported. And so that is a much closer context for our feet than a vertical jump. So you can already see that if we look at a more context-specific example, Well, here's an example of someone absorbing energy without using their ankle to as a shock absorber. Right, so already that example's done. Like, as soon as you come up with one example that's different, if they say this is how this is all the time, and you come up with one example for, well, wait a minute, here's an example where it's not, then their argument is done. The whole thing is shot to crap, and they have to come up with another argument. So already, like, the vertical jump being given as a reason for doing this, you got to come up with a better reason because it's a different context, okay? So we need to look at more context-specific stuff. So things like swings, things like a surfer, right? A surfer, no one's ever going to accuse a surfer of not being athletic. He's riding a surfboard. His foot is not coming off of the board. And so you'll see he's got a balanced foot position where he's able to get pressure under both ends of the arch. And he's able to absorb energy and create energy and turn and all these things from this, you know, midfoot position that you'll hear some coaches out there. Like, I've actually heard people say, like, no athletic movement takes place from a flat foot position. All athletic movement takes place on the ball of the foot. And it's like, well, wait a minute. What about a surfer? He's being athletic. You know, so, like, that's another, these statements aren't true, but they get thrown out there like they are, and then people just go, oh, okay, yeah, that makes sense, and we're without questioning them. But unfortunately, like I said, there are plenty of examples where you are being athletic, you are absorbing shock, and you're doing it without landing, using the ball of the foot and the ankles as shock absorbers. All right, so if we look at, so what does the ankle joint do? It's not a shock absorber, all right? If you look at the ankle joint, it is one of the smallest joints in the body. It's a small, weak joint. It is not surrounded by large muscles, and so it has bad leverage, okay? Like, your foot creates a lever arm. So the further the pressure is out, or the stress is out on the foot, the more that stress is magnified through that lever arm. So if you have pressure under the heel itself, and then you put that same exact amount of pressure under the ball of the foot, the stress that's going into the ankle is magnified out on the ball of the foot because of the lever arm that the foot creates. Okay, so you don't want to be doing that, right? Like, mountain biking has to be one of the only sports where they're looking to place extra stress on the ankle joint. Like, pretty much every other sport recognizes the ankle joint as an injury-prone, sensitive joint. And you want to be trying to minimize the stress on it. You want it to have as much stress as it needs in the context, but you don't want to be adding extra stress to it. No one's out there trying to figure out, how do I put extra stress on my ankles? Okay, so it's not what you're wanting to do. It's a small joint that's easily injured, and that's not what the goal is. So the ankle joint is not a shock absorber, right? Your hips are the shock absorbers of the body. If you look at your hips, they are surrounded by the largest, strongest muscles in the body, and they have great leverage. They can create great leverage both in absorbing or creating and absorbing energy. And so it's the hips that you want to focus on. Your hips are your shock absorbers. And so you want to do everything you can to allow the hips to move efficiently so they can absorb the shock. And this is where the problem comes in, is that your foot has to be in a certain position and stabilized correctly to let the hips do their work in the most efficient way possible. If your foot is not stable or it's in a bad position, then you're taking away from the hips. The hips can't work as effectively. So this means that being on the ball of the foot is going to screw you over in two ways. Okay, I've already mentioned both of these things, but the first is the extra leverage that you're creating. The further, if you have one pressure point under the ball of the foot, you are creating extra stress on the ankle joint through the lever arm. And this is why you see people's ankles buckle sometimes. And in extreme cases, you'll see Achilles tendon tears. I mean, Rachel Atherton tore her Achilles tendon at a World Cup downhill race a few years ago. It was a rough landing on a drop jump. Like, most of the girls were riding around it, and she went for it and hit a bomb hole, and man, her ankle snapped down because, again, she had nothing under it, nothing supporting her heel itself. And so the force went into the ankle joint, and something had to give, and her Achilles tendon went. Okay, so you'll actually find that if you look into it and look at pictures and stuff, you'll see most World Cup downhill riders actually run more of a midfoot position than you're led to believe. Like, their cleats are either slammed all the way back, or they've actually drilled holes to get them even further back. Because, again, they realize that the further forward that pressure point is, the more leverage it's going to have and the more stress it's going to put on my ankle. And so it's going to make it tougher for make your ankle more injury prone. This also creates overuse injuries, okay? Because your ankle is like trying to support the back end of the arch, your foot starts to get stiff. So plantar fasciitis, Achilles tendon problems, these things stem from an unsupported heel and you trying to overuse the ankle joint as opposed to having the foot stable and in a good position and taking stress off of the ankle joint, which will take the stress off of these structures there. So, and you know, it gets you in two ways, right? Both when you're riding, you increase the chance of hurting your ankle, and over time, you're going to get stiff and tight in those areas and increase your chance of getting injured. And second, by having nothing under your heel, okay, having a stiff-soled shoe is not the same thing as having something under your heel that you can put pressure into. Not having something under your heel makes your arch unstable. And your brain will not allow your hips to move the same way if the arch is unstable. It senses an unstable foot, and so it starts to interfere with how you're able to move, because an unstable foot isn't able to absorb and create power as effectively, and so it's going to take away from your body's ability to try to create those forces because it recognizes, I can't do this. This is why in the gym, you're told to drive through your heels if your heels come off the ground. Like, you have to have pressure under your heels in order to get the your hips to move properly. This is why in Olympic weightlifting, an Olympic weightlifting coach will tell you to slam your heels to the ground, because you got to get your heels down flat before the weight starts to drop back down. Because if you don't have your feet flat and you're able to start using your hips immediately, then you're going to be screwed trying to catch your weight in Olympic weightlifting, doing power cleans and snatches and stuff, or cleans and snatches. So your hips aren't able to move as effectively. And then you start to put pressure on areas where you don't want it. Okay. So your ankles, your knees, and your low back start to take some of the stress that's meant for your hips. If your hips can't move as effectively, then these areas start to take that stress and they're not meant for it. So again, you start to see both acute and chronic overuse injuries from this. So it's not good, all right? So if you want to avoid that, you need to get your foot stabilized properly. And so you're able to, again, like, so what is the foot doing, right? What the foot is doing, or not the foot, the ankle is doing, is getting the foot into a position to let the hips do their work. And so when you look at a vertical jump, from this, again, the vertical jump is a bad example, right? Because we already established that, because we're not jumping off of our bikes, but you can still take a look at and see the same movement principles apply here. That, yes, the ball of your foot touches the ground first, but what happens after that? Your heel touches the ground and your ankle is not absorbing shock, right? It is getting the heel down so your foot is flat, and now you can use your hips properly to absorb the shock. So it is assisting in the shock absorption, but it is not a shock absorber itself. Or at least you don't want to be trying to use it that way, right? I'm not going to say it doesn't absorb any shock. That's not what I'm, it's not what I'm saying. I'm sure there's some force that it's absorbing. But what I'm saying is, like, that's not their primary job. The primary job of the ankle in absorbing shock is not to be shock absorbers themselves. It is to get the foot in a position to let the shock absorbers, which are the hips, do their job properly. And so this is what you see with a vertical jump. Okay, so you're landing this vertical jump, and you're getting the foot flat in order to absorb the shock. And so no one lands a jump on their toes, right? Like, what they're a better example of what they're telling you to do would be to do a box drop, right? Like, you're standing on a box, and you're going to step off and you're going to land on like a 2x4 that's on the ground. You're just going to land the balls of your feet and you're going to try and stop your heels from touching the ground. Okay. So like this, that's exactly what they're asking you to do. When they're telling you to use the ball of your foot to absorb energy, that's basically, but your heel is never supported, right? There's a difference between your ankle being used you're having pressure on the ball of the foot and eventually the heel as well, and never getting pressure under the heel. OK, Okay, not that, like, that's not the same context. So even a vertical jump is a different context because you have some pressure under your heel, which you don't have with this, you know, on your bike if you're on the ball of your foot. And so, again, it's just, it's, I understand where it came from. I used to believe it, right? I've taught it. I've used ball of the foot, and it was through my own research and experience and things like that that started to lead me to believe, like, hey, there has to be a better way to do this. And again, hopefully, some of the stuff in this podcast will give you some stuff to think about in order to maybe go in that direction. So the, like I said, you know, kind of wrapping things up here, there's a lot of examples where athletes absorb shock without using their ankles to actively do it, right? So like I said, we've got surfing, skiing, snowboarding, skateboarding. I've already talked about doing swings in the gym. You know, when you look at analogies from sports and activities that have the same context as mountain biking, you see a really clear picture, okay? And that's that you need to have both ends of the arch supported so the foot spreads out the forces going into the ankle and it makes it easier to recruit the hips. Okay, so on, like I already mentioned, like on a personal level for the riders listening to this, man, if you've got plantar fasciitis, if you've got Achilles tendon problems, you've got knee pain, low back pain, and you ride, you know, especially clipless pedals, but even you know, regular flats, if you're on the ball of your foot, this is why you have these problems. Okay, being on the ball of your foot creates a crappy situation for your lower body, and it has to adapt to this by getting stiff in the ankles. And it spreads the force that's meant for the hips out over other joints that aren't meant for it. So it also makes it harder to move properly on your bike. Again, if you're standing up, you're trying to corner, you're trying to manual, you're trying to do these dynamic athletic movements on the bike, and you're perched on the balls of your feet, and you've got no support under your heels, you're not able to use your hips as effectively. And so, like, I see a lot of riders out there struggling with pain and with frustration about not being able to improve their riding skills. And both of these things are directly tied to their feet being in a bad position on their bike. And if they would fix their foot position, that both of these things would improve almost immediately. So, and, you know, I will say, yes, there are a lot of good riders who use a ball of the foot position. Really, that's just a testament to their mental focus and the human body's ability to adapt to just about anything, at least in the short term. What you don't hear about a lot of times is how much pain those same riders are in or how hard they're working to keep it under control. I mean, pro riders have a whole team. They got massage, chiropractors, cryotherapy, you know, just all these things to help keep the pain under control. And these things add up over years, right? There's a difference between adapting for the now and creating sustainable movement habits. And so if you want to do this for a lifetime, you have to find a way to move on your bike that works with your body, as opposed to trying to impose some, you know, preconceived idea of how you should move on the bike. It's like, well, no, how does your body optimally move? Now let's apply this to the bike. And that's what led me to these insights in the design of the Catalyst pedal and all these other things, is looking at how does the human body optimally move? Well, let's just apply that to the bike. It seems logical, but when you really start to think about it and you realize, like, that's not how the mountain bike industry and the cycling industry goes about it. They are not looking at you, the human being on the bike, and trying to optimize things for you. They're looking at the bike and then trying to figure out, well, if we were creating a machine to drive this thing, what would it do? And now let's tell the body to do that. And it's just a totally different way of going about it, right? Like looking at the human first versus the bike first. And you realize that you can come to two very different conclusions that way and really miss some important things. And that's why the cycling industry and mountain bike industry is where it is because it has not done things from a movement-centered standpoint. So, you know, I fully expect that there to be a lot of pushback on this. Okay, it's just like the clipless pedal industry is clinging to the pull-up on the backstroke story to help sell the need to be attached to the pedals. I fully expect a lot of well-meaning skills coaches and organizations to stick with this. You need to be on the ball of the foot to use the ankle to absorb shock story. And, you know, this isn't a matter of personal preference or what works for you now. You know, might not work for everyone. Like, you know, these are kind of nonsense arguments that people throw out there. I hate the one, everyone's different. It's like, well, then why are we even doing anything? Like, why are we studying anything? Why are we trying anything? If you can just throw it all out with the statement, everyone's different, what is the point? Hey, that's such an asinine statement. Like, if you can't say, well, everyone's different, and here's, you know, some science or a context appropriate analogy or some sort of movement principle or something, you should be able to have something to back it up other than personal preference, or what works for you might not work for everyone. Like I said, those are nonsense arguments that really do a disservice to trying to move our sport forward with what, you know, we're with what we're doing here. And so I will, before I sign off, kind of wrap things up, is put a challenge out there, I guess, to the skills training industry and coaches in it. It's such a young part of the mountain bike industry. I mean, when I first started mountain biking in 2000, like, skills coaching was an unknown thing. I mean, you had a small handful of people who were doing it, but it was a very, you know, very rare to come across someone. It was a very niche thing. And now they're everywhere. Now the skills coaching industry has just exploded. I mean, every resort has some skills coaches. I've got, just here in the town I live in, I've got some, you know, these skills coaches that live here. And it's like, who are these people? Where did they all come from? Right? Just all of a sudden, within the last few years, there is just a ton of skills coaches. And it's just, you know, people who are, that, you know, they mean well, but you got to realize that at the end of the day, you're a movement coach. If you're going to work with a human being and you're going to try to help them improve their skill, ultimately, you're trying to help them move better. And that makes you a movement coach. And you owe it to yourself, you owe it to your clients, you owe it to the industry to educate yourself in these areas. It's not just about the bikes, and it's not just about memorizing the 10 steps of cornering or whatever it is, right? It's about understanding, how do people move, and then how can I help them move better? And again, you don't have to, you know, your people aren't signing up for like a personal training session with you. But if you don't understand like what a good hip hinge should look like, or what a good squat should look like, and have a few, you know, coaching cues or things in your back pocket that can help someone maybe do them a little bit better if they're struggling with them on the bike, then you're missing the point. You're missing the point. We're trying to help people move better. And so you have to understand movement. You have to understand how it applies to the bike. And this will also help us avoid some of this confusion, right? Like, the more people who understood good movement and good movement principles, the harder it would be for things like this to exist. Like, an educated consumer is very hard to fool, but a consumer who doesn't, you know, he doesn't know any better, you can tell him just about anything. And so if you don't know anything about movement principles, like, you don't understand there's a difference between the context of when your foot comes off the ground and when it doesn't come off the ground. Okay. If you don't understand that, then how can you be the most effective coach possible for the people coming to you and asking you for help? So, you know, you're probably going to have to dig into areas outside of cycling. But if you want to be a coach, you want to work with people, especially on the skills training side, and help them move better on their bikes, you have to look at yourself as a movement coach, and you have to understand how to coach people to move better. You know, how the words that you use are important. This is why things like elbows out, that's a terrible coaching cue. I mean, there are studies on this. I'm reading, I forget what the freaking name of the book is. I'll look it up here in a second. There's a book that I'm reading by a guy named Nick Winkelman, and it talks about the science of, it's called The Language of Coaching. Okay, but there is science. People have actually studied how to effectively coach people. What type of coaching cues work and which ones don't work as effectively. You know, what type of practice sessions work and don't work as effectively. So this isn't, there's an art to it, but there's also a science. And if you're not looking at the science, you don't understand what this is, then you can be doing your people a disservice. And so again, like, elbows out is an example of this. This is a bad coaching cue. This is an internally focused, process-driven coaching cue that has been shown to be ineffective for helping people to actually improve their movement efficiency the way that we want them to. All right. So but again, there's a lot of examples of that. But if we do a better job of educating ourselves on these movement principles, how the words that we use impact what people are taking away from what we're doing, how to structure training sessions properly, then we can make a huge impact on helping people move better and have more fun and improve their performance and skills on the bike. But it's not going to happen as long as we've just got these freaking, you know, yahoos out there. Like in jiu-jitsu, it's hilarious, man. Like, you know, it takes 10 years to get a black belt. So someone who's only been training for like 2 or 3 years is, you're considered an idiot. You don't know nothing, right? But what we have is a lot of people out there who are the equivalent of like a blue belt. They're like a 3-stripe blue belt in jiu-jitsu. You know, they've been riding for 2 or 3 years and man, they're pretty good. And now they're a skills coach. And it's like, dude, you haven't been riding long enough to even know what you don't know yet. Okay. But you don't have any like black belts in the area to kind of help you realize that. And so, as a blue belt, if you've only been riding for 2 or 3 years, man, you also need to understand, like, you've got a long way to go to really understand what's going on. And you can't just take some weekend certification or whatever, just start calling yourself a skills coach. Like, you're going to fuck people up. Okay. You're going to mess people up. I've seen it so many times. People that I work with, it's like, what are you doing? Well, I was working with this kid at so-and-so resort and he told me to always drop your outside foot in a corner. It's like, Jesus Christ, man. Like, what is going on here? And so now not only am I trying to show this guy what to do, but I've got to help him unlearn a bad habit. Like, that's the thing. Like, you can screw people up as a coach, man. You give people bad coaching cues. You give people bad, bad ways of doing stuff, and you can mess them up and you can make it harder for them to actually improve. So you can tell, man, it's a little frustrating for me to watch people who, you know, working with people who are trying to get better. And it's like, where did you learn this from? And it's like, wait a minute, who's that dude? Just some kid at the resort that can ride well. And they're like, oh, here, you're a skills coach now. It's like, you know, what the hell, man? Like, no wonder people are so confused. So, but this is where crap like this comes from. You got to use your ankles to absorb shock, because this is who's telling you this stuff. These people who don't know what they're talking about, all right? And no one else knows what they're talking about. So who's going to call them out, right? So anyways, you need to be an educated consumer, people. And the skills training industry needs to do a better job of understanding movement principles and how to apply them, and not giving people bad advice based on just traditional crap. So, you know, being on the ball of the foot to create or absorb energy, it's an old, outdated concept. We got to move past it. You know, really, our sport isn't very old. I mean, cycling, as we know, it's only around 150 years old or so, and we've not had the time to work through the bad ideas like some other sports have. Okay, it's okay for us to have made a collective bad decision based on the best info we have, or we had at the time. But really, guys, it starts to become sad the longer we hang on to these ideas once they've been disproven and actually shown to work against us. So again, if you think that it can't happen, right? Like the best example, the most recent example I like to give people is in high jumping, the Fosbury flop, what we think of today is the high jump where you run up and you turn your back and you jump over with your back facing the bar and your head, facing the sky. That's called the Fosbury flop. And before he came along with that technique, people were using the scissor kick, where you run up and you scissor the legs. You throw one leg over and the other leg. And world championships, you know, Olympic medals, gold medals were won using that technique. And this guy, Dick Fosbury, comes along with this new technique. And of course, people don't want to adopt it. They start poo-pooing it. He even wins an Olympic gold medal with it. And they still were disparaging it. So, but here we are, you know, all this time later, and now the vast majority of high jumpers out there use the Fosbury flop. So if you think that it can't happen in cycling, if you think that all of the pros can't be wrong, right, then I don't know, man, you're living in a dream world, because it's happened time and time again in countless sports and countless industries, and it can happen here. So, you know, just having this smug certainness that this is how all the pros do it, so therefore this must be the right way to do it, man, that is a false sense of security that you have. And history has shown that you will eventually have to deal with reality. And so in this case, the whole ball of the foot position is one of those things that I think in 50 to 100 years, people are going to be looking back. The vast majority of riders is going to be using a midfoot position with their foot stabilized properly, going, man, what were they thinking? Like, what took them so long to adopt this better idea? Like, we're riding with less pain, we're performing. Like, this is so much better. Like, why on earth were they so entrenched in that old idea of the ball to foot? But, you know, again, you can point to many different times when this has happened. But if you want to be one of the early adopters, man, dude, if you got to wait for everybody else to do it before you're going to do it, there's a saying good old Mark Twain had that when you find yourself on the side of the majority, it's time to check your position. So anyways, yeah, there's something to be said for people who just wait for the majority to do it before they accept it. But hopefully that's not you. Anyways, if you have any questions on this or anything, let me know. You can hit me up at james@bikejames.com. Always happy to help. If you got questions or something you want to see me talk about on future podcasts, and again, remember to visit bikejames.com, where you can sign up for the newsletter, and also pedalinginnovations.com, where you can learn more about the Catalyst pedal and order you a pair and start to take advantage of, like, you know, good support for your foot. In fact, it's funny, one of the top feedback that we get from people about the Catalyst pedal is my pain is gone. You know, they've had ankle, foot, knee, low back pain, plagued them for a long time, tried all these other things. Catalyst pedal, ride or two later, it's gone. Okay, I mean, just that's how transformational having proper foot support can be on your bike. But besides that, the second thing that I hear from people, a most popular thing, is how much more stable they feel when doing downhilling. That having your foot, whole foot stabilized and letting your hips move properly actually makes it so much easier to absorb shock, and you feel so much more stable. And downhilling is actually more fun when you have proper foot position. So yeah, you can check that out. We have a 30-day money-back guarantee, so that if what I'm saying isn't true, send them back and I will give you your money back and you can go back to your small pedals. But either way, hopefully you guys have enjoyed this podcast, giving you guys some things to think about, and I will talk to everybody next time.